This is emotion art. If you're a human, you are made out of emotions. The goal of emotions is to create, and what emotions create is art. Emotion art. In my experience, all this creation is so much more fun in a village. So satisfying. I'm super thankful to the community that's coming together around this project. Buddy Anderson, donating his time, keeping the audio sounding good, and elevating the whole experience with his musical art. Buddy's conversation is coming soon. And if you haven't already, check out his music on Spotify at From Another Mista. Angela Cook, bodywork and energy healer, keeping us on task and taking on the bulk of editing and research. I mean, if I listed off everything that Angela does, that'd be the whole episode, so I'm just going to say thank you. Angela and Buddy, thank you for everything you do. And thank you to everyone else who shows up in the ways that only you can. I am so thankful to know you all. What a cool village. This is a conversation I had with Randy, someone I met on a Facebook podcast group. I wasn't sure what to expect of this conversation since it came from a random connection on the interwebs. And I gotta say, it was fantastic. Randy has a really unique background and perspective. And we were able to talk about some things that are deeply meaningful to me. I really like how this conversation turned out. Thank you, Randy. I look forward to collaborating with you more in the future and being part of your support village, whatever way makes sense. This is so fun. Speaking of fun, if you're listening to these conversations, then you're also part of this village, and we appreciate you. And we want to hear from you. Our socials are at This Is Emotion Art, and my email is in the show notes. Drop us a line. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy.
Welcome to Emotion Art.
Emotion Art, where we sit down and make art.
Emotion Art.
Creative energy moving outward in conscious expression of feeling.
Emotion Art.
Emotion Art. Emotion, because we are literally made of emotion.
Art, because everything we do wants to be art.
Emotion Art.
Emotion Art.
Emotion Art.
It's all beautiful.
Emotion
Art. Emotion
Art.
Emotion
Art. A space for emotional art, creative energy moving out in conscious expression.
This is emotion art.
You're welcome.
All right, so this is it.
This is it. I think you put a post on the Facebook podcast group, one of the ones I'm in, saying that you're looking for people to guest on your show. I believe you said that you were a radio, a traffic reporter. What the heck is that like?
Okay. I guess I'd have to back up. So I just started the podcast. Let me make sure that I have, cause I got two screens on here and I want to make sure that I'm not, distracted. Let's get a blank. There we go. Okay.
Do you have ADHD?
Oh my God. I'm one that I was never diagnosed, but I realize now I absolutely,
how do you take care of that? What do you do for your ADHD and how does it affect you?
I have managed it a lot better in the last couple of years. Honestly, the thing that has helped me the most in the last couple of years is SSRIs, which is a whole other conversation.
Light strobe type therapy?
No. That's like antidepressants.
I love displaying my ignorance. Okay. Antidepressants. Oh gosh.
We can get into the details later after I answer your first question.
I should introduce myself. My name is Michael and I ask a lot of questions and sometimes I lose the thread, chasing the sparkly thing. You're welcome to shut me down.
Yeah. Well, no, not at all. I want to answer all of them without going on, you know, 10,000 tangents.
Perfect.
I guess to tie that in, my ADD, like, it benefited me in my career in radio because I had to multitask constantly. Mm. And like I tell my wife now, I say, I do not multitask anymore. Mm. So I turned 45 this year. My dad had his first heart attack at 44 and passed away before he turned 54. So the last 15 years, I mean, pretty much since like right before I met my wife, you know, up until now, I guess, you know, there's been a lot of refocusing, you know, yes. And just realizing that I can't do that anymore. I can't take myself out of presence that much.
Yes.
And survive,
yeah.
You know, and live well. So yeah, to back up, I grew up in LA and I guess to introduce myself.
Yes.
And I appreciate you having me on, Michael, because I know you, even when we went back and forth and you said, why do you want to be a guest of mine? Mm-hmm. You know? And, it seemed like more of a natural thing. Like,
yes,
I threw that out in the thread in my brainstorming of the podcast. And now as I kind of realized and expected, it's, you know, it's going on certain turns and
yes.
I haven't done any guesting yet yes. on mine.
As they know? Do.
And, yeah. So I'm still not sure what I want to do with it, mm-hmm. you know, whereas I figured you got your thing and I'm eager to get my voice out and share my story and be a part of the community and all that. So I appreciate the opportunity. So yeah, my name is Randy Keith. I grew up in Southern California. My parents grew up in New York. So my mom moved to LA to become an actress and my dad followed. And, we always had music around the house.
Sweet.
My dad was always singing. My mom got me into piano lessons at 2.5 because I was already starting to tinkle the keys. And I mean, some of my earliest memories were sitting at the piano when I was whatever, 3 or 4.
Hmm.
So like my entire childhood, I felt like I didn't want to end up being a performer because I didn't want it to become work,
right.
You know, because I saw my mom struggle as an actress, and I saw my dad struggle, and both of them struggle as business owners in the 80s, you know, before they were working 7 days a week before cell phones,
right.
You know, just because that's what they're doing. But so I always kind of pushed it away as far as a career. And when I was 4, I started making, I always had a tape recorder. I'd record myself playing piano, talking, making believe I had a radio station, mm-hmm. interviewing people, interviewing my brother. And when I was 9, I said, okay, I'm going to make believe I have a radio station. So I'll call it KRAK. It's my initials, KRAK 98.5 FM. And so I made a little theme song, KRAK 98.5 Santa Clarita. And I have all the archives, by the way. I'm going to start,
yes.
I'm starting a new YouTube channel that I'm not going to advertise. That's going to have all of my like stuff that I did as a kid and when I was on the radio when I was younger. So yeah, I always.
That you're not going to advertise, but are you going to give me the link or the, or where to find it?
Oh, I'll give it to you. Sure, sure. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not going to include it on my podcast stuff,
gotcha.
Like my official, you know, advertising stuff.
It's, gotcha.
It actually, what gave me an idea was, you might know there used to be a shock jock named Tom Likas that was pretty big in the Northwest.
What? That name sounds so familiar. Oh, that sound. I know. I listened to that. I mean, that feels like yeah, a name from my childhood.
Yeah. Cause you're about my age, right?
Uh-huh.
You're
43
ish.
4 to 3.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
I think.
Yeah.
I forget sometimes.
Yeah, so he was, I mean, he was syndicated
from LA. Yeah, bro, I remember
LA,
the 80s.
But...
Hell yes. And all the non-cell phones and then the car phones and all. I'm sorry, I cut you off. Okay, he was syndicated.
Yeah, no, it's all right. My point about Tom Likas was, because I started looking up some archives of his old show.
Okay.
And his handle is My Box of Tapes. And I know it's him that's uploading all of them because who else would have all of these raw tapes from 30
right.
years now,
right.
you know, of the whole show.
Yeah.
So that gave me an idea. I was like, I'm going to do the same thing because I, over the years, I've digitized so much you know, that I had when I was younger. And so that became an actual real radio station. So
wow,
I found a ham radio when I was 11. Radio Shack was my favorite place to go when I was 9, 10 years old. You know, I knew that. I knew that entire catalog better than the people that worked there. I remember I tried to get a job when I was 16 and they're like, well, you have to have this and you have to have that. I'm like, dude, I know the catalog better than you. Like, resistors are on page 85, but like I knew all of it. But anyway, I got into ham radio. So I got my ham radio license when I was 11, and that led me into...
You probably started talking to people in other countries. That's what I had some friends with ham radios.
Oh, yeah. 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 I actually brought in my seventh grade history teacher, who I still stay in touch with. I was like his, you know, I was the teacher's pet. So I brought in my ham radio. It was like this 100-watt, you know, solid state, had the tubes and everything. Yeah. I brought in this dipole and, you know, and I'm thinking it's, you know, this is so cool. Seventh and eighth graders going like, oh man, this, you know, this geek. So I was just always fascinated by like radio and numbers and voices and everything having to do with audio. So my dad bought me my first mixer, my Fostex 4-track X16 mixer when I was 11. And so I started mixing and like recording different horses and just, yeah, I have so much from when I was 10 to 20 of, that's where I really learned how to like play and sing. Mm. Like I would do cover songs and my stuff and all that. So yeah, so I would always do that on the side and saying, I don't really want to make a career out of that. So I made radio my focus for my career. So I got a job at a radio station when I was 14, which was growing up in Southern California, was right after the Northridge earthquake. It was a huge, it was a milestone for many people living there.
Yeah.
And, where I lived in the Santa Clarita Valley, there was only one radio station and they served the whole valley. So I started basically like, I was 14, no, I was 13 before I started working there. My parents would drive me off at the radio station. I'd just like hang out. Of course, one of me took me under his wing. And 6 months later, I had my first radio show. It was called Teen Scene, the only radio show for teens from teens. It was on at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. So my mom was the only one that listened. It was like,
wow.
The manager of the radio station goes, okay, you want to be on the air? Here's what you have to do. You have to go out and sell your sponsors. You have to record the commercials. You have to work with a co-host that isn't going to do anything. You have to do all this stuff and to get it on the air. So that was my kind of crash course in radio. And I always played with it. And from there, I basically networked with people that worked at other stations in LA, and one of them that ended up being one of my mentors, he tried to get me the job. He's like, "Yeah, you want to get a job working for the traffic department?" You know, it's like I don't even have my driver's license. Like I can't drive to LA. So I called up him like 4 years later when I was like, "Okay, I'm ready to do that." So that long story. Almost as long, I started working at Shadow Traffic, which was the agency that distributed all the traffic information, basically, to all the radio stations and TV stations. There was Shadow and Metro Traffic at that time. And so that was 98. I was 18. And I started working there as a producer. And then I became friends with the people that flew in the helicopter and in the airplanes. So I was actually the one who would dispatch them, who would say, oh, there's, you know, I check out CHP log and there's an accident on the 405, you know, go check that out. And they would report back to us. So I said, yeah, mind if I go up for a flight? Actually, the first time that I went up in the helicopter, I distinctly remember, because in order to get to the helicopter on time, there was a tennis tournament in town and that was 98. So the headliners that night were Agassi and Sampras, I think. And I gave up box seats. I'm a big tennis fan. I gave up box seats to see Agassi and Sampras at the UCLA Tennis Center, which is not a huge stadium. It's like a very intimate stadium, because I wanted to go in the helicopter. which happened to be the first time and definitely not the last time. But
was that desire because you wanted to just kind of see what it was like, or was it because you wanted to be up there doing that reporting? Like, where did that drive come from?
All of the above. Yeah, all of the above.
Okay. You were just enamored.
Once I saw how it worked, it was like, oh, this is easy. Yeah, so the traffic thing, I mean, yeah, I was always fascinated by traffic. When I was 7, we moved from San Fernando Valley to Santa Clarita Valley, which is like 30 miles. Mm-hmm. And I'd hand-draw maps of the way to go. Mm-hmm. And I remember, in fact, I probably have it right here. I have all of my old Thomas guides.
Oh, my goodness. This is fantastic. Ha ha. Yep, I remember those.
This is Anchors area. I took this from Shadow Broadcast Services. We used to have all these, when I went flying, we used to have all of these books in the plane.
You figure out a way to like prop it on your steering wheel, like the zoom in of the city, and you got to like get the big paper map and fold it up just right. And then
That was the nice thing about the Thomas guide was it was never like that. So this, I actually went to a secondhand store and went and got older maps so I could compare them. Like that's how much, like this is 1986 and this one I think is like 74 or something like that.
You have these like on hand right here, right now. You are fascinated by maps.
They're on my bookshelf. It's my office, but yeah.
But is that the same fascination? Because it feels like it's tied together in your mind with your fascination with traffic.
Oh, absolutely.
So what is the fascination with maps? What is it that draws you to them? The pattern of it?
I guess so. I mean, like if I think about like when I used to, you know, when I used to draw them and when I was a kid, like I would love knowing everything about the road. Mm. Like, you know, okay, the exit numbers and knowing that, you know, on the 405 between the 101 and 118, you're gonna see Burbank and then Oxnard and then Victory and then Sherman Way. And Sherman Way has an east off ramp and a west off ramp, and then Roscoe and then Nordoff and then Devonshire and then 118. And 118 only goes to there's one transition road that's not there. Yeah, like I know, I love knowing all.
What I was picturing the whole time you were talking about the little you, the data you that drags his whole apparatus to school was like the Goonies or Stand By Me, like a movie, movie from the 80s. And that is like, those are my favorite kind of movies. So that was a fantastic,
speaking of movies, did you ever see the movie Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater? He's like running a pirate radio station. He was really young. Anyway, that was shot in my high school.
Are you
serious? It was shot at my high school like 3 years before I went there.
Oh, okay. So you weren't involved.
I wasn't there, but it was still super surreal. Like when I became a freshman and I'm like walking up there and then somebody tells me about the movie, and it was right when I built my actual first radio station. So after I got my, that's why I was telling you I got my ham radio license, because then I became friends with somebody who introduced me to this company at the time. You know, at the time it was catalogs. There was no internet.
Sure.
So he's like, here's a catalog and it's all transmitters. You can make your own little FM transmitter. I was like, oh my God, that's my dream come true. I could have my real radio station from my room. So I built a little transmitter. It's like a half a watt transmitter. And I would tell my friends across the street, you know, down the street to listen. I have recordings. I'll upload them. And then when I started working at the actual radio station, I was so excited because back in the day, you had to make mixtapes. If you dubbed it from the radio, mm-hmm. you didn't have the beginning of the song or whatever. But I started working at the radio station. They have like unlimited music library. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just going to take some CDs home and record some stuff. So, yeah. Oh, man.
That brings back memories, recording from the radio.
Yeah.
Never quite catch the song right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. But that was my youth. I was recording. I would record either it involved me DJing something. I always was trying to have the radio voice, mm-hmm. and playing the piano. And that was pretty much my high school, college, at home life.
Was that the only time you went up in the helicopter?
Oh no, that was the first time. And then I went with one of the other reporters. And I think it was like a couple months later that they started working. Like in the year when I said, yeah, I want to do this.
How long did you do that for?
Almost 10 years.
Wow. So you were the guy in the helicopter, mm-hmm. with the rotor noise behind you talking about what you're seeing.
Yeah, I was actually 90% of the time I was in the fixed wing. So that was like a big misconception that everyone's, oh, you're not in the helicopter. Okay. Like, no, helicopters cost, and this was, you know, 25 years ago, helicopters cost whatever the number was, $600 an hour to operate, because you got jet fuel, it's more expensive to operate than a single engine Cessna. Mm. So we would fly in Cessna 172s and we would fly along the right side of the freeway. And that's how we would fly. Like most, like when pilots, I ended up getting my pilot's license after I started flying, because I'm naturally, we're up there all the time. And it was such a different world flying for traffic versus learning to fly. Mm-hmm. Because when you learn to fly as a pilot, you fly airport to airport, point A to point B. But all of the flying that we did, if we're going from LA to Fullerton, we're going to go down the 405 and then over on the 10 and mm-hmm. down the 710 or on the 91 so that I can look at all those freeways so that I can report on them. Mm-hmm. But when you're just flying, you don't care about the traffic, right? Like, so it was always, even when I got my pilot's license, that was like a completely different perspective. I'm looking at landmarks in a different way because I'm always looking at them in reference to the traffic. But yeah, when I started flying, that was like what blew my mind. Like what exploded my interest, you know, in traffic and maps and patterns. Cause it was like, whoa, when they say like, okay, you have certain landmarks that you can figure out where you're at on the freeway. The 10 at La Brea is a four leaf clover interchange. You can tell that from the air. It's like, oh yeah, it does look like a clover. Mm. Oh yeah, it's exactly like it is on the map. Like it's just to see that, especially the first time I flew over my house, it was so trippy because I had this image that like north is a certain way from the ground, but then when I went over it, it's like, oh no, it's like we're more like this way. And I mean, you're in the Northwest. Like whenever there's mountains, there's always some kind of disorientation, you know, when you're like thinking that you're driving a certain way, right?
I've thought of applying for a handicap placard because of my inability to determine direction. I can never tell which way is north.
My mom.
Ever. And if I'm in Corvallis, where I live, sometimes I have to turn the opposite direction of what I think I should turn because my gut always steers me wrong.
That's how my mom is. Always say whatever you think, go exactly the opposite, and
yes,
that'll be right.
That's pretty much the standard I live by. So the flying is what really lit that on fire. You still do that now?
I haven't flown in. So I started reporting in 99. I got my pilot's license 2000. That was before 9/11. Had a friends of mine would say they shouldn't be called near misses. They should be called near hits because you did miss. It wasn't a near miss. So I had a near whatever when I was flying in June of 2000, where we were just flying along right side of the freeway. And I look up and there's this plane coming right at us. We like missed by like 15 feet.
Whoa.
Just what evasive action did the pilot take? Nope. Just that was all God or whatever. So that like scared me from flying for like 6 months or something, because I was starting to do my grad school for my pilot's license. And I was like, oh, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to do this? And then like a couple months later, I'm like, yeah, I do. It just goes with the territory. It didn't. It scared me away for 2.5 months.
Okay.
I think it was.
So how did that era end for you? Like, what got you out of it?
Out of radio was I discovered dueling pianos. So a friend of mine, when right after I turned 21, was like, hey, there's this place at Universal City Walk called Howl at the Moon, and they have pianos. You can go in and blah, 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 blah. I was like, pianos? Hey, sign me up. And I went in, and have you ever seen dueling pianos? Are you familiar with it?
I'm seeing pianos with, like, rapier swords. No.
Yeah, no.
Not even close.
No, okay. No, we don't bring the swords.
Please
sometimes
enlighten
I wish
me.
I could, though. What I say is my pitch is that dueling pianos, we set up two pianos facing each other, and it's an all-request show. So, like, we say dueling, but it's not really dueling. It's mm-hmm. more like two pianos
playing together,
putting on a show. But
Got
it's not
it.
Just playing. It's is playing, seeing. It's basically like we play weddings, corporate events, we play at bars and restaurants. Like we do anything that a band does, but we don't have a set list. Everything is request and everything is audience driven.
Whoa. That's what you do. You sit on that piano and whatever people throw at you, you just start playing and singing and cajoling around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've been doing full time since 2004.
How do you do that the first time?
Well, that's the thing is I walk in and I saw them playing Sweet Caroline or Piano Man or one of the most popular ones. I was like, I could do that.
Yeah. And you were playing when you were two or three.
Yeah, I mean, I knew all those songs, yeah, and that was, like I said, when I really got into Elton John music when I was in high school, and that was the whole time, and I was recording myself and mixing and stuff, so, like, I played, in those days, it was fake books, we didn't have apps, it was sheet music and fake books, or listening to the song and playing it by ear, which is a lot of what I do anyway, but for songs that, like, I really didn't know, or just wanted to read it, I'd pull out the fake book and okay, yeah, let's play. But yeah, so the first time I thought, I was like, I can do this, and I didn't realize that it was like a career for these guys.
Yeah.
I come in, I was 21 and I was definitely in my know-it-all chapter. And I was like, oh, I can come up. And then I went up and they said, oh, if you want to come up on stage, it's $20 for stage fee. It's like, but they know who I am, like I could play that song, So they say, well, you can come back on Tuesday. It's you sing it Tuesday on Tuesday night and play for free. So I came back for the next 3 years every Tuesday and got to know all the guys. And I would come to the club on other nights also. But after 3 years of cajoling and learning the repertoire and taking notes, like I literally would sit in the back of the club and go, okay, he played Brown Eyed Girl at 5:32. He said, sing sha-la-la-la-la in the middle of the song. Audience did not respond. 5:35. Yeah. I was a student of every transition, what people are saying. And again, like my radio background, like one of the first things that was beaten into me, my first job when I was 14, when my boss wrote me a 2-page scathing email telling me to shut up because I talk too much and let my co-host to talk.
Yeah.
He would always tell me that, first of all, it's not you all out there. There's so many guys that I work with who are like, how y'all doing out there tonight? Like, we're not out there. We're in here. We're together. You're not on a stage for 25,000 people. Like the whole idea of the concept of dueling pianos of sing along that I saw, that I learned, is that the concept is you come in a party at your house and there's a piano in the corner. You go, hey, Randy, go play a couple songs for us. Hey, everybody. Yeah, come on, sing along. Like it's that kind of atmosphere. It's not let's perform a concert for 2,000 people. It's let's have a good time and have a party. All of us people having a good time.
That feels like it would apply. What I hear you saying, that feels like it would apply to a podcast where instead of having the intention of speaking to a huge audience, you have the intention of speaking to people who are in the room with you. Like you're speaking to a room instead of a crowd or.
But that's the idea that I fought for so long that that's what my first boss was saying is that that's true for radio also. That's true for broadcast radio.
And you had to learn that.
I had to learn that, yeah, because okay. I just wanted to be the announcer guy,
and
especially doing traffic. Like, I mean, we had to be quick. Everything was always quick. Mm. Like, it had to be quick. So, I worked for years on slowing down, on sounding more conversational. Obviously, the first couple of years were taking out my ums and ahs. Like, that's something that you and I see in the podcast groups a lot.
Yes,
it's a conscious thing that. Yes, it takes a conscious effort.
Did you ever go to Toastmasters? Speaking of taking out ums and ahs,
I did Toastmasters when I was in fifth grade.
Oh my goodness!
I think that was Toastmasters.
Okay, of course, I should have just known that. It is an awesome program.
I won the district competition for my speech on Earth Day.
What would you say that your strong, like your strengths are? Like, what is your strongest competency? Would you say speech?
I would say probably performing before speech, because like a situation like this is reminding me in those moments. Honestly, I can't remember the last time I've had a conversation like this, especially on Zoom, like in a long time.
Whoa, like what is it like this? What do you mean like this?
Just speaking one-on-one without distractions, you know, not a text message or a, you know, like I don't really talk to people unless I'm in the car driving. Or like that's the time when I get to talk, because I have a 3.5-year-old now, and so I'm either taking care of him or at work or maybe sleeping or now trying to work on my podcast.
You're exhausted. Ugh. Why? And well, from what you're saying, it's because of all the things you got going on, and a young kid takes it out of you no matter how you approach it.
Yeah, and we knew it was coming, because, you know, people would ask us when we were talking about having kids, like, how are you going to do that? Because you guys work at night. Mm. It's like, well, I just have to wake up earlier. Yeah. Like that's pretty much been the solution. I usually get my naps, but when I don't, like, it's just, it is what it is. You know, my wife and I we have a great life, and we're very grateful for, you know, for everything that we have. And I've had so many, you know, so many lessons that have reminded me that, like, there's always going to be work, right? There's always going to be work, no matter what, no matter who we are, no matter, well, maybe not certain people in the 0.0001 echelon, but, you know, we all have to do laundry and wash our face and brush our teeth and, you know, like, do dishes. Nice. And if not that, then, you know, one of us has to go to work, or like there's always work. So I need to be grateful for that, for the ability to do that work and to reap the blessings from it. But yeah, it's, I have some days when I'm tired. It's a different kind of tired now, definitely a different kind of tired now than when I was in my 20s and working at the radio station and going into the piano bar at night and doing Amway meetings the evenings and dealing with a psycho girlfriend and getting a restraining order against her. And after my dad passed away in 2003, the following 2-3 years were pretty shaky. I had lots of lessons. Yeah.
And you don't have to feel appreciative of anything. Hopefully you remind yourself of that sometimes. Human beings cannot always feel appreciative when they're in the burnout phase. It's not possible.
Yeah, but
maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
Yeah, I mean, I just know my all my lessons in recovery and you know, in that space are that gratitude is what heals everything.
Recovery.
Yeah, I've had a few addictions that I've dabbled with, and you know, like I said, the psycho girlfriend was what really opened up my mind to the possibility that I know there's something. I remember I would tell people, I know there's something wrong with her, but there's got to be something wrong with me that keeps going back to her. Mm. And that was my like first aha moment when I started going to therapy and realizing my codependent relationship with my mom and how I was still recovering from my dad passing away and all that stuff. So
that is such a difficult hill to walk up. Coming face to face with yourself, your awful, slimy, ugly, codependent self. That's not fun. But you did it.
Those couple of years were it was a lot of discovery.
Yeah.
And going back to when I had mentioned about, you had asked how I deal with ADD.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked in radio from 1999 to 2008. And that's when I left LA in 2007. And that's when I decided to pursue doing pianos full time and finally leave LA, because I had been telling myself that I wanted to get out of LA since I was a kid, but it was really my dad that wanted to get out of LA, although it was good that I got out of LA too. So I went straight from LA to Kansas City, and I lived there for 4 years where I first experienced being away from home. Really, I was 27 when I really, really left.
Wow.
As I kind of got backlogged after my dad passed, because I was still living at home then. It was right after I'd for this college. So yeah, there were those years, but it was when I had started in therapy and when my therapist had said that my move to Kansas City was going to be one of the hardest things that I've ever did. And she was definitely right about that in the sense that like I was forced to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize until I left LA, until I really left, like for couple weeks, couple months.
Got over
like
the culture shock.
Just the pace, yeah. Just the energy of the city and just being able to literally sit and take a deep breath. So when I was in Kansas City is when I started doing yoga and I started getting massages every month. And then it was every other week and it became my massage day. And then I also, in LA, I had started going to 12-step meetings for codependency. And then a friend of mine who was in AA was like, dude, you sound like an alcoholic. You got to go to Al-Anon because Al-Anon is for friends and family of alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was dating an alcoholic. And then after I was done dating her, then dated another. So, you know, I had some lessons to learn. But yeah, that's how I started. That's how I started in recovery. It was like recovery in relationships, really. And then I had always known that I had addictive tendencies toward certain substances and certain images and certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's that road too. So I've been in a couple different 12-step rooms since 2008.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what's your relationship with the whole program now? Like, is it still an active part of your life? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's definitely a way of life for me.
Okay.
I'm definitely not one, at least in this chapter of my life, that's as actively participating as I was when I was single. And I would go to, in the days when I was like really struggling with anxiety and depression, like I would go to meetings sometimes 3-4 times a week just to be around people and to get out and to get out of my head and just stop spiraling.
It's a tool you have in your toolbox.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's fantastic.
But now I haven't been to an in-person meeting since before COVID, just because we moved in COVID and we're kind of further away from towns, but I actually go on phone meetings. So I've become an active member of a call that's actually national. So I moderate the meeting a couple times a month. So I'm involved that way. And I stay in touch with people in program, both in that program, and other programs. My personal opinion, which of course the traditions of 12-step, all 12-step programs say, Tradition 11, that we do not have opinions on outside issues. So that's why I disclaim this with my personal opinion, mm-hmm. is that everybody needs some form of whatever you want to call it, 12-step, recovery, therapy. Each one is one of the tools in the box, because it was my therapist that said, I need to go to 12-step so that I can hear other people that are like me, not just her on her pedestal as a therapist that I'm paying, you know, but that's what they say. Some are sicker than others. We're all, you know, we're all helping each other, you know, in the program. But she said I needed to go for at first to keep my mouth shut so that I can listen to people rather than talking all the time, because that's what I would do, especially in those days.
So I feel like you're really appreciative of the experience, and
absolutely.
It's very beneficial to you. I'm curious, why do you think that it would be beneficial to everyone?
I think that our world is in the state that it's in because of, you know, it's a macrocosm of our individual, you know, behaviors and actions.
Sure.
I think that everyone's got something. There's something that all of us can be addicted to, abuse, overuse.
Mm.
And, you know, unless we've had like the perfect, whatever that is, you know, childhood, like we all have some kind of trauma, fears, memories that need to be addressed in order for us collectively to live together peacefully. Like in the program, I've learned hurt people hurt people.
Yes.
So, you know, if I'm an angry person, I'm going to take it out on myself, but I'm also going to take it out on you, you know, whereas I've got to lead by example and address that wound so that I don't have to re-perpetuate it. really the foundation of the program is first of all, self-love. Like if I'm not appreciating myself, if I'm not, you know, feeling good about myself, then I'm not able to have healthy relationships.
So basically, I'm just going to extrapolate. If everyone in the world could see themselves better, if everyone in the world could love themselves better, I'm translating self-love, then that would make the world a better place. Well, I sure agree with that. Boy, there's a whole hell of a lot more ways to get there than through therapy or group sessions, though.
Well, and that's where I did want, before we got into too many other tangents,
yeah,
to go back to the SSRIs, because one of the ways that, because I did struggle with the anxiety, with the depression, with the addiction melding its way in there also, and you know, coping and trying to figure out, you know, basically I ended up self-medicating for a couple of years because
I got
a medication. And then I was like, I don't really want to be on medication for the rest of my life. So I would like wean off. And then after I moved between 2007, 2012, I moved 7 times across the country. So like, I didn't want to get another doctor. I didn't want to have to so like for a couple of years, I was ordering pills from India, like just because I was like, you know, they always gave me the same prescription. I'll just, you know, take this. And, but I realized in retrospect, after I finally came off of it, that like, I think that I had that, like there was that issue that whole time because I wasn't staying consistent. So I convinced myself that it wasn't working and that I didn't want to do that. So I said, I want to try and find an alternative, some kind of alternative. So long story short as possible, at least to get there, is that I met someone who was actually one of our massage therapists. I mentioned I started doing this, getting deep tissue massage, and the lady that was our massage therapist, she says, I'm not going to be doing massage anymore because I'm getting into to different alternative techniques. I'm doing cranial sacral therapy, which is like where she like holds your head for like a half hour.
Yes.
Yeah. You,
yes.
And Angela, like, okay,
yeah. Angela that helped us problem solve in the beginning. Yeah. We are in her massage studio.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And she is something special, let me tell you.
Yeah, I bet.
I've been on this table. She has magic hands.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, go on.
Yeah, so our massage therapist, she said, I'm going into cranial sacral massage, and I'm also getting involved with plant medicine. And I was like, oh, what's that? Oh, well, mushrooms and ayahuasca. And so long story short, between 2019 and 2020, 2 years, I did 3 mushroom ceremonies and 7 ayahuasca ceremonies.
Wow.
And the, like the impetus, well, the first number one thing was that I wanted to be able to not have meds, because in order to do any of the ceremonies, you had to be off SSRIs. So once I was off, I was like, okay, if I'm ever going to do this, it's like, it's now. And so I was, like I said, over the period of 2 years, and I had some amazing insights, and I could get into that, but from the standpoint of the anxiety, depression, that was like what I realized was happening was I would have this like peak of like serotonin during the ceremony and for like a week afterwards, and then it would be dumped out. And I was like depressed out of my mind. And of course, this was right in the middle of COVID too. But even before COVID, I was seeing signs of that, where like I had debilitating anxiety to where like I couldn't decide if it's 11 o'clock. I don't know. Should I take a shower? Should I go to sleep? Should I take a nap? Should I go downstairs? I need to be doing something now. Mm-hmm. Like I was like that, like constantly for like months and months and months.
Were there any stories behind it? Like what were the underlying stories that were telling you weren't safe?
I mean, again, at that point, I really think it was all my brain chemistry.
Really?
Because yeah.
There weren't stories behind it. It was just the abstract.
I mean, there were a few because yeah, we were in the middle of COVID and we had a bunch of gigs canceled.
Sure.
And I had the guy that I was going to go into partnership with, he ended up starting his own company right before COVID. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, there were some stressors, but it was like extreme to where I was, there was no explanation.
And that's super interesting because my experience with anxiety and depression, deep, deep, deep was the opposite. It was all story based. It was all that I believed my life was falling like in absolute pieces. I had no idea. I was just terrified, not knowing who I was or where I was, and then coming to realize that that's the state I was in. And so it was all story based. So that's just,
yeah. I mean, I've had those experiences, you know, at certain times,
sure.
But yeah, especially in the middle of COVID, like, no, it was just, I actually got the shaman that was leading our ceremonies. She referred me to an alternative healing doctor that basically gave me a sample kit thing that I did, like saliva and urine test or whatever. And it tested my neurotransmitters. So it gave me this whole thing. Mm. This is how much GABA you have. This is how much serotonin. This is how much dopamine. This is how much whatever. And every single thing, it was July 2020. It was like the low of the low. It was like all of these signs show that you do not have a zest for life. And you like, it was like describing exactly how I was feeling within the 30 days that they recommend, you know, when you get on to an SSRI. Since then, I have not had anything close to the anxiety attacks that I used to have in that 2019, 2020 period where I was completely off of SSRIs. And I'm on a super, super low dose. I'm on like 10 milligrams with like the normal dose is like 40 or something.
So that's what helped you ultimately. Because now, you didn't really say what your experience with ayahuasca and psilocybin was, but it didn't sound positive.
Well, it
did it help?
It helped with a lot of my existential questions, honestly. Like,
okay.
I mean, go ahead.
No. I just need to let you keep going because you'll probably answer my questions. I'm just curious what you mean by that. Like, what are the existential questions and how did it help?
Again, the main selling point that the lady that was leading the ceremonies with to me was to do the ceremonies for my addiction, which my addiction is sex addiction, porn.
Okay.
I mean, I've been aware that I've had it for years and I've gone through ups and downs of wanting to stop and not wanting to stop. And, you know, I'm an addict, like it or not, you know?
Yeah.
And so
and you have to deal with so much shame.
Yeah. And so I was, this healer was, you know, she was saying, I'm called you. She was telling me that a lot of people are, you know, helped with addictions and that she had experience with, you know, sex addiction, that sort of thing. So I kind of went into it with that mindset. Like, you know, this is my way to finally, you know, have whatever. And in that time, actually, that was one of the longest sobriety periods that I had throughout COVID, partially because I was so depressed. I really had no desire to act out. And part of the preparation for the ceremonies was you can't do anything. Like there's no sexual activity. There's no salt in your diet. There's no meat. It's very, very strict to keep your body cleansed and all that kind of thing. So, and that was one of the things. So again, just like kind of being on the train of not being on SSRIs for the first time in my life, I was like, I'm just going to, you know, give this the best I can. And I did for 2 years. But to answer your question, the insights that I got, I mean, the first ceremony that I had, it was the first time that I ever realized the meaning of letting go, because it was the first time that I actually like physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, all in once, felt the weight off of my shoulders. That is like, oh, this is what it's like to like, I didn't understand when they tell you about being in ceremony, especially for this kind of psychedelic, it's a very inward experience. And the first thing she would tell me is you close your eyes and you focus on your breath. That's it. And then the medicine will lead you wherever. Some people see things, some people hear things, some people feel things or combination. And I'm definitely visual. So I was seeing Lucy in the sky images, you know, like I was seeing anything that you think you might see in a hallucinogen, like I saw it at one of those ceremonies. But the commonality was that this feeling of comfort, of like, I've been here before. There were moments when I could see, I felt like I was seeing past lives or certainly memories. Like I had a distinct memory, or at least a feeling of a memory of like right after I was born, like I could hear my grandparents there. You know, they passed away 10 years ago. That was also a big thing for me too, was it was a huge healing experience for my grief for my dad. I mean, there's one weekend I 3 hours straight, just bawling my eyes out, like so hard, you know, like it hurts and you had to start throwing up and coughing just because I'm crying so much, you know.
So was it a pretty traumatic experience?
The ceremonies? No, they were no traumatic experiences. I mean, there were a few moments where I would kind of like dread it. Like, you know, the people that I worked with, like they did really well with prep. Like I've heard of people that say, oh yeah, I've just, you know, I heard about ayahuasca and I went to the, you know, I went to the forest and I just did it. Like what? Like, no, I prepared for 2 weeks. Like we set an intention, we did meditations. Like we did, like there's, it's a ceremony. Like it was a whole, like I slept the three or four first ones that I did, they were one-on-one. They were like in our apartment. Like we were so wow. Lucky. Even the group ones that I did were small groups. Like they were very, very intimate. Yeah, every time the experience was just feeling the mass consciousness. Any of it is hard to describe because it's all experiences, right?
You're feeling like a part. You're a part. You're one. Yeah. You're part of it.
Yeah. After the first one, I remember being just so angry. I was like, because I could just feel the anger of the human race. I'm like, people just suck. Like I was just so mad. But yeah.
Where do you think all that comes from? Like all that stuff that you experience, is that just the ayahuasca plants that? Does it fabricate it or what the heck is it?
I mean, that's what I've been trying to figure out since then, because I think it's a mix, you know, it's a mix of whatever's literally going on in the brain, because it's all the DMT and the firing and the hallucinations or whatever. But there's definitely something to the spirit world or the ancestors or whatever, whatever you want to call it. Like my dad, who has passed away in 2003, was absolutely there. Like there were other people there that were like, you know, what's your dad's name? Robert. Oh yeah. Robert's here. Like they're not making that up. You know,
do you have a religious affiliation?
I was bar mitzvahed when I was younger. So my dad was Catholic and my mom is Jewish. And my dad's parents died when I was really young. So it was only my mom's parents that were around. So when I turned 12, they're like, are you going to have a bar mitzvah? I was like, okay, what do I have to do? You know, well, if you learn some prayers and you get a bunch of money, you know, okay, sure. So I took a crash course in Hebrew from my friend's mom who taught at the Hebrew school and learned Hebrew in 6 months and did my Torah portions. So like through high school, I was really trying to be Jewish. And college too, when I got to UCLA, like there was a big Jewish community, which is, I'll just leave as a side note that I'll put on the Box of Archives channel, my recording Elton John songs with Mayim Bialik. She was in Big Bang Theory. I will put a recording of me singing Elton John songs with her.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah. She's great.
Yeah.
The names don't mean anything to me. My brain doesn't hold on to them.
That's great. See, I grew up in LA with my mom as an actress, and she still to this day name drops all the time. Even my wife, like, my wife's from Wisconsin. Her family is totally, totally different. She's got like 8 aunts and uncles and 52 cousins. You know, they've got a big family. Like me growing up, it was me, my parents, and my mom's parents. Like that was it. We didn't, like, everybody else was either really distant or got my aunt and uncle in San Francisco. And that's it. So yeah, so I grew up Jewish, but then after college and after, I mean, there was a whole bunch of stuff. My first girlfriend in high school was a Baptist. So I had my first experience with people who didn't like Jews.
We have a similar heritage spread with the Irish Catholic and Jewish. That's my mom. Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
I learned enough. I can read. I can sound out Hebrew and stuff. But okay, before we stray too far from a subject that tickles my interest a lot. So what about the mushrooms? Because it sounds like you had fewer experiences with those. But I'm curious how it compares.
Yeah. So what happened was the lady who got me into it, she basically was like, when she mentioned mushrooms, and I was like, oh, I've always wanted to try that, whatever. So I got all excited about that. And then after like the second one, she goes, well, I'm working with ayahuasca now, and that's really what's gonna like get the job done, you know?
Okay.
And so I actually was not going to do it, but my wife actually had one scheduled at that time. And so I was like, oh, well, if she's doing it, then, you know, I better.
Oh boy. Story of Adam and Eve all over again.
Yeah.
But she ate it. She forced me to eat it. No.
But I did. I actually did, after my last ayahuasca ceremony, I actually did a mushroom ceremony again after that. And it really wasn't as strong, but because I had had those other experiences. Mm. But again, by the time I had my seventh ceremony, I was trying to figure out, you know, is this really the solution, or am I? It was actually my Al-Anon sponsor who not so nicely told me, oh, well, you just want to get high. That's why you're, doing this. Like, well, there may be some truth to that, but you don't just go into an ayahuasca ceremony because you want to get high. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you do some shrooms just to get high. Like, that's doable, but not the stuff that I was doing. I was also doing a, like, complimentary to the ayahuasca ceremonies. They have this thing called Combo. Have you heard of that?
Nope.
It's a secretion of a gland that they take out of a toad in the Amazon.
Oh boy.
It's a poison to the toad.
Great.
And so it's this like little ball.
I have to put another thing on my bucket list. Oh my gosh.
Anyway, so when it's embedded into your bloodstream, it makes you vomit within 3 minutes.
Okay. Never mind. It's not going on my bucket list. Why do people do this?
It's part of the cleansing, part of the getting out the bad energies and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, so I did like 4 or 5 of those.
There are way more peaceful ways to rid yourself of bad energy. That sounds traumatic. Oh, but now I'm curious, so I am going to look it up. Okay, so mixed reviews here. And then ultimately, it sounds like you went from there to the SSRIs.
Yeah,
what exactly is an SSRI, by the way? I'm sure every other person in the world knows.
Serotonin something reuptake inhibitor.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's basically it's the acronym for the standard like antidepressant, like any Prozac, Prozac, and what's the one Zoloft and all this. They're all SSRIs.
Okay, so it just makes you feel gray.
I mean, it's supposed to. It balances out the chemicals.
Sure.
So it was actually the shaman that was leading some of the other ceremonies that had recommended the alternative doctor that she says, oh, it's not working. Oh, it's not doing that. Well, you might need to, when she said, you might need to use Western medicine. I was like, but wait, I thought this was the answer to everything, you know? And that's when I kind of realized like, oh, you know, anything can be a belief system.
Yes.
But for right now, this is not working. So yes, I need to try the other thing. And like I said, I mean, since January 2021, I'll have some anxious moments or whatever. But I mean,
sure.
my son was born. There were some things that I would not have. I have no idea how I would have been able to deal with them before. So I guess to summarize for you, I guess what you're getting at with the ayahuasca experience, I mean, I've heard stories where people get off of SSRIs and they do one ceremony and they don't need SSRIs anymore because it regulated the chemistry of their brain or whatever. It didn't work that way for me.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I thought that's what was happening, but what was happening was actually the opposite. So
do you see yourself doing it again, or is it just like, okay, that was a chapter, had its benefits, but I'm not going there again?
Let me put it this way. When I realized that I wasn't going to be able to do it again, I was like terrified of getting back on SSRIs because I was like, well, then I'm never going to be able to, like, I won't be able to do it again. Like that was then feeding into the anxiety. So to answer that question, I'm not sure. I mean, okay. I think that I would still like to get off of SSRIs one day. And certainly if I am off of SSRIs, then I'll be able to do that again. And I mean, at least mushrooms, like you said, I know is a much, for lack of a better word, easier experience. than the jolting, you know, ayahuasca or peyote that I knew some of the other people did also. So that definitely sounds like something I would, I'd like to try again. As I mean, that was where one of my ceremonies was where I finally was like, okay, I'm ready to be a dad, because I was pushing that off for a long time.
I've heard stories like that before. That is so cool. I really, really appreciate that story of a naturopath doctor that directed you. I don't know if you said naturopath, but that's the feeling I'm getting. Directing you to Western medicine SSRIs that are very villainized in some of the more, you know, naturopath community, because I think that's what's wrong with the world, is that nobody figured out yet that there's a place for everything. Literally everything has truth in it. Everything does something, helps someone. Everyone just freaking relax. Find the thing that works for you. Find the thing that helps you, and let other people find the thing that helps them.
Well, it's like one of my favorite series is the Conversations with God series. Have you heard of that?
Okay. I've heard of it. It rings a bell, but...
Yeah. And he goes into many, many times about how, you know, we look for, or we label, you know, right or wrong, or, you know, which one or whatever. Well, how about it could be both?
Yeah.
No matter what it is, like,
exactly.
You can both be right. The Eastern and Western. Like I said, I was in a terrified state when I was in my anxiety. And when she told me you may have to go back on meds, I was like, I can't believe that I'm going to have to do it, but I couldn't believe even more exactly like you said that she said that, because one of my other shamans actually told me the exact opposite. She goes, oh, if you get back on meds, then you're just covering up the problem. You're just putting a Band-Aid on it.
Do you think it's possible for you to ever be completely healed, like a completely healed human?
I mean,
completely whole.
That's the thing, is that we're all imperfect. There's no way to be, and we can't.
The word perfect brings up like making mistakes, and I'm not talking about making mistakes. I'm talking about inside your emotions, being able to be completely, all of your rhythms be in absolute harmony, just complete harmony inside yourself. Do you believe that's a place that is possible to find?
Yes. Maybe only for a few seconds at a time.
I'm talking about persistent, a place where where your life becomes that harmony.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it possible for humans to?
Yes.
Because I don't know very many people who I think would have any claim that they are anywhere close to that, but I'm just curious. I love to ask people if they believe it's possible, because most people say no.
Yeah, I think it's possible.
Life's just big stress, and then you die.
Well,
it's hard not to see the world that way sometimes.
it can be, but another way to look at it is everything is a distraction. That was one of the first things they told me. I said everything is a distraction. I remember I was sitting, tripping on my first mushroom trip. I was sitting on my patio outside, and this woman walks by that I'm like staring at. And I said something to the shaman that was, you know, helping me in my apartment. It's like, what's going on? I was like, oh, just a distraction. She goes, everything is a distraction, because everything distracts us from that self-love, from ourselves, from breathing, from taking care of ourselves, from
being right here.
Yeah. And from practicing gratitude. I mean, because most of the stuff out there is just noise. But yes, I do think it's possible.
So with all this stuff going on, why are you starting a podcast?
I'm starting a podcast because since I got that job when I was 18 years old, I started writing content. At first it was going to be a website, because I was like, okay, there's no place that you can go to for like traffic tips. In those days, it was like, oh, you could go to the radio station website, you know, go to our traffic page at knx1070.com. And all they had there was the map, which everybody has that now. You know, I'm talking about before Google Maps, you know, where you had to go online and see the thing. And I just I always felt like there was a resource that was missing. So I started drafting a website, and then a couple of years later, I started writing a book. I was like, oh, I'll make a book about all the different traffic patterns. And at first it was just going to be about LA, because that was what I knew, and I couldn't talk about traffic patterns in other cities. And then a couple of years later, it's like, well, maybe I need to generalize it so it's not just for LA, so that then I could, you know, actually sell it. And this is on and off since the year 1998 that I've had this content kind of floating around on my computer. And it wasn't until I started talking with a friend of mine when I went back to visit in LA, first time I'd been there for a while, went saw a childhood friend of mine that produces podcasts that has a studio. And we're just talking. He's showing me a studio and we're chatting. And then after I see his studio and after I go back home, I go, you think maybe I can have a podcast about traffic? Like, you know me, you know how much I, you know about traffic. And like, we've known each other since we were 8 years old. So, so it's like, yeah, because first he said, I don't know if people would be interested in what are you going to talk about? I was like, well, I got all this stuff from this book. And then I started using ChatGPT. I didn't know about ChatGPT until like 3 months ago. And it was actually my mom, who produces all my videos, that has been trying to turn me onto it. So I started just feeding in like, hey, I've got this idea for, you know, a traffic book and blah, 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 and maybe a podcast. And, oh, well, that's a great idea. We can lay out your episodes like this. And okay, great. Now I'm not afraid of content. I think that was my imposter syndrome fear was like, okay, sure, I'm passionate about this, but how am I going to make it? How am I going to make it appealing? So it's not just me. Of course, now I realize how important the niche is and how there are other people that are really interested in traffic solutions and engineering and whatever details. So that's where I started getting the confidence of like, okay, this is something that I can do on an ongoing basis, and I can bring on guests and I can bring on friends of mine that I used to work with. And it was exciting thinking about it, because I'm literally doing what I did in my room when I was 12 years old with a microphone and computer recording, but like, people are actually listening to me now. You know, it's not just me doing it for fun or to practice. And so, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much it's going to take off. I know what my goals are and how much I want it to, but at the very least, it's going to be out there and somebody's going to hear it. And just the synchronicity of that decision, then like 2 weeks later, I got my Buzzsprout hosting thing, and I got on their mailing list. And 2 weeks later, I got the email about PodFest. That's like, oh, this is in Orlando, and they're talking about networking. And I've been to expos like this before when I did Amway, when I did networking groups for my business. I'm like, I need to go to this. Just all of that kind of timing was like, this is my time to have a podcast.
I only just heard about PodFest. I'd like to go, but that's a long way away from Oregon, man. Especially when you have a huge family and all the stuff, all the busy stuff.
Yeah,
it but is. I think like I'd like to be able to listen to some of the talks and stuff. I think there's a way to. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, and I'd be really interested in your feedback, because I've been real deliberate about keeping the episodes short, because I want it to be interesting.
Oh, I'm definitely going to check out whatever your content is.
Yeah, I got 5 episodes up. Yeah, I got that. And then I started my YouTube channel, and I'm doing shorts every day that are cut up from the episodes. Yeah, I did a bunch of shorts on parking lot traffic after the Super Bowl. And I actually got, like, in the last 7 days, I got 4,000 views. Like,
I can imagine. I
think that's pretty good.
Yeah. And I just can't even imagine what you're saying. So I'm super curious. But I mean, everybody drives, and I mean, the reason I reached out to you is because I was like, oh, he's looking for people on his traffic podcast. And I've spent the last 2 decades driving everywhere in the Pacific Northwest, and the past 2 years commuting to Portland, from Corvallis to Portland, every workday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's like 98 miles from my house to the shop. It's just what I do, man.
But you said you've driven all over Northwest, so you up Seattle and up really close to everything.
Yeah. Oh, so much! Like when I was a technical rep, I traveled the 5 Northwest states. I drove to Seattle every other week for a long time. I drove out to Boise, the Tri Cities, Medford. Like, those were just the common trips, and then I would drive in Hawaii, and I'd fly over there every month or so, Alaska and.
Driving Hawaii.
A lot of driving. Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes. But the truth is that I used to hate every second of it, and I would listen to the radio. I had to have the constant noise quick, because you know what it's like as a brain that can't shut the fuck up. There is no way to shut that thing down. And so you got to fucking drown it out. So you're chewing gum and chewing. I mean, I still chew my nails and freaking I have a beard and I pull out my fucking beard hair. It's because my brain is just constant. You know what I'm saying? It's just that energy. It's that spaz energy. And I'm trying to get control of all of my addictions too. Yeah. And I mean, seriously, I've been fantasizing lately about cold turkeying everything. Caffeine, nicotine, everything.
I had a friend of mine that stopped smoking a couple months ago, and I remember the like first couple weeks was pretty on.
Oh, it's got to be miserable. But yeah. I'm like, I want to know what it feels like to be completely clean. Just have no different chemicals fighting for my attention and my just to be clean. And I'm terrified of it, honestly, because my whole life I've fought my wild, crazy ass brain. But I've learned how to stop fighting it. So I'm ready. I know I'm ready, but still, it's still scary.
I mean, the awareness is the first step for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, man, there's another question. See, I keep doing this. Blanket on a question I wanted to ask about. Something I'm trying to let to stop cutting you off. I want to ask the thing, but I have to ask it in the moment or risk this. So
please do next anyway. Time.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to.
The first place I left when I left LA was Seattle. I was there for 6 months. And I remember thinking, like, I couldn't believe that traffic was as bad as it was there. Like, coming from L.A., you think that no place is as bad as L.A., which there are certain spots where you can say that. But, I mean, I sat in some pretty bad traffic in Seattle. On 5 through downtown and on the bridges and stuff. Like everything was just, like, so much more narrow.
In Seattle?
Seattle, yeah.
99. Dude, I know. And driving in Seattle was just a nightmare. Was just a constant nightmare. The thing I'm curious about, I'm going to check out your episodes, but I'm just like, what could you say in a podcast that's actually going to help me? How is this going to benefit me, the commuter, listening to your podcast? That's what I'm curious about. And so the truth is, I'm going to get my answer when I listen, but I'm curious what you say.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea that I've ever had about driving philosophy is that the way we drive is a reflection of our personality, right? So
yes,
people that drive like an asshole are, you know, probably have aggressive personalities, right? So do I want to be that kind of person? Do I want to be, you know, expressing myself that way? Because just like in everything in life, what I put out there, it's gonna come back to me. And if I can be a part of the solution rather than the problem, then it actually helps traffic. I've done research that's the other thing that now I can actually use research that backs up that, no pun intended, that will actually support my claims of using cruise control, of not using the brake as much, of making all your movements gradual, of driving like a truck. That's one of my domain names. I say, because if you drive like you have a huge cargo, you can't make sudden movements. And the more of us that make less sudden movements, it will actually improve traffic. It's scientifically proven that if you're not stepping on the brakes, that's just, it's causing the chain reaction. And I've always said that 95% of traffic is predictable because there are patterns to freeways based on their merging, based on how people behave on them. And so my argument has always been that if you know what's coming up ahead, you're not going to be as pissed off, right?
Like, is there going to be an emotional or spiritual self-help aspect to it?
Not yet. I think that's going to come. I'm actually thinking, so I was going to write the book, and now I'm thinking that I'm going to do two books, and one's going to be a mini how-to like guide, and then the second book is going to be more personal stories and with more of a spiritual aspect. Yeah, I think that may be the way to go. But I think it's too much, at least right now. Like, I did meet a guy at PodFest that he talks all about law of attraction. And, like, that's one of the episodes I want to do. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you're all the way into the spiritual self-help field.
Yeah. But that's just one episode. Good. You know, like, I definitely want to keep it palatable, you know, to where it doesn't get too. I want it to be practical. So I guess to answer your question, like the biggest thing that I'm going after, which I need to refine because I don't think it's strong enough, you know, is, well, with these techniques, you can not stress and, you know, have less, fewer accidents and better gas mileage. But I mean, ultimately the goal is basically creating a better flow, like going back to the we're part of the system, you know. And if you have any interest in trying to at least be aware of what kind of driver you are, everybody thinks they're a good driver. Like my wife tells me, you can't tell people that, you know, they're doing this bad or whatever. Everybody thinks that they're a good driver. But if you have that awareness that like, oh, I didn't know that that worked that way. Like just having that one little awareness could actually change your driving habits. So that's what I'm getting at to start.
So, and that's that, I appreciate that. And you're telling me how, and you're telling me what, but I'm not hearing anything that really answers the question why. So I'm just going to ask that question. Why?
Yeah.
Why are you, Randy, starting a podcast right now? What's the why?
Oh, I want to get it out. I want to get the, like, I'm tired of having this content on my computer.
I hear you saying it's because you have something to say.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I've always been passionate about. And obviously, even if it's only in one episode or in one portion of the book or whatever, there's going to be some kind of spiritual or whatever aspect that I want to weave in. So that's going to be my kind of personal, you know, touch to it, which I also have different drafts of books on personal recovery and building a business, which are separate things that I'm still have planned also. But yeah, that's why I decided to do it with the traffic, because I feel like I love the process, right? It's probably the only content that I can think of that it's automatic for me. I mean, when I go into Audacity and I can, you know, and even that, you know, to do one episode, it's like, okay, sorry, honey, I needed 2 more hours, you know, like it's just, but that's because
I'm so frustrating.
It can be, but it's also, that's just in the flow. Like I haven't been in that flow since I worked at the radio station. Yeah. 25 years ago, like for me to be back in that flow, because like my wife says with our piano business, this is, I'm between my podcast and book, and she's also writing a book. She's writing a fiction series. So this is like our year where we're laying the content to finally be financially independent.
Step into the next chapter.
Like that's the plan, because.
Yes. I love to hear this.
This is the way that it's going to happen.
Yes. Okay.
I can book more shows or whatever, but I don't want to be away from the house more, you know, like being able to produce at home, and the more time that I'm home, the more time I have to put content out there. Like it's serendipitous that way. So,
But the financial freedom, you're not doing it for the money. Like even if this is not your ticket out, even if it doesn't get you where you want to go, will you still do it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Especially in the book, because.
And I freaking love that you see that the reality is you can live a different life where you are free in the sense of freedom being discretionary time. You get to do what you want with your time.
Yeah. I mean, we've been manifesting that kind of life since we moved to Orlando. Like that was one of the big reasons that we moved to Orlando, was because as performers, it's one of the few cities in the country that's a 7-night-a-week town. Like we have corporate events, we have things that happen all the time. Whereas even in LA, it really was just a weekend town where most of the events happen on the weekend. So like that has afforded us, my contract at CityWalk is Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So like my plan has always been to be able to try and figure out whatever schedule we need. But yeah, I've looked at alternative streams of income and all that kind of thing for years. I dabbled with songwriting and, you know, oh, maybe we can, you know, do that. But this just, it seems the most viable way, but it's also exactly what you said. It's because I want to do it. Mm. I'm going to do it no matter what. But while I'm riding the wave, I'm certainly going to, you know, shoot for some high goals.
Yes. And when you achieve those high goals, will you continue dueling pianos?
Oh, I'm always going to perform. Yeah. My contract at CityWalk, I work with guys that are in their 70s. I am going to be playing the piano there until I can't play the piano anymore.
Okay. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm so blessed with my contract. I work 3 days a week and I have benefits. I have health. Like it's my first real job. I tell people I got my first real job at 42. Because I was always a contractor before that. I was always chasing gigs and working in different radio stations. Or 1 year I had like 16 1099s, or W-2s, whatever. I worked everywhere.
So you've been on this track for a while. So does it feel like this more recent shift is a new build in momentum?
I think it's just serendipitous with the technology. And like I said, when I found out about PodFest, I mean, I made in that first week that I launched my podcast, I made some solid connections, like just great people that I'm fans of their podcasts. And hopefully, you know, they'll guest on mine at some point, like just so many great, I got probably in a year, you know, what would have taken a year in education and all that there. So like just getting all
that. I
want
to go so bad. Oh my gosh, that would be so fun.
Just getting all that was like, that's the thing is like, I live in Orlando and this is here. Like how bigger of a sign can I have that this is my time to do it, you know? And just the way, just like I said, with my wife also creating and we've set up our workspaces, like it didn't happen before. Like it wasn't happening when, you know, when our son was just born, cause we were preoccupied with that. And up until this point, you know how it is with career, like the schedule just gets too busy. So it takes a conscious effort to go, wait, I need to take off one night so that I can spend more time on the podcast if that's what, you know, if that's what I want to do. So yeah, I honestly think like if just the, well, also now that I think about it, the trip when I went back to LA, where I saw my friend who records podcasts, the day that I got on the plane, one of my friends in my recovery program, I found out that they passed away. And this happened to be somebody who was on my phone meeting. So it was actually somebody who I had known for 4 years, but I had never met him face to face. And I didn't know his last name. And after he passed away, I found out his last name. And I found out that he is a 10 times New York Times bestseller and one of the leading music biographers of Seattle music.
Wow.
He wrote biographies on Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix and Bruce Springsteen and Ann and Nancy Wilson. And like, I knew he was a big deal somehow, but I didn't know exactly what he did because 12-step is all about anonymity. So we don't share our last names.
To your point that we're all broken.
Yeah. So when I found that out and I talked to him every night. We would text, we'd be on the meeting every night for 4 years. And just realizing like, wow, this guy was like a big deal. And I have zero excuse. I have this material here. You know, it's all here. And I clearly like, especially after going to podcasts, PodFest, when people say, you know, do you have, you know, what's your story or what's your this, like, I know I've got the story and I've got several stories. It's just figuring out how to present it and how it's going to be most useful.
Well said, because you have stories to tell. And what you're doing is you're just starting to tell them because that's how you figure it out. You start telling them.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of us out there. You have way better idea of what your story is than I do, or at least of the structure of your starting point. I just was like picked up a hitchhiker and started talking and recording, and it's developed from there. And I'm starting to see the shape of what it's going to look like. Like I'm starting to see some foundation structure come up of directions I could go and stuff. But to me, it's just every single conversation is so interesting. And so we're hitting different things and seeing different things. And this physical three-dimensional world is an illusion. Like I believe that's true. And so the way you see the world is the most valuable thing that you can offer the world, because the more that people realize that they're the only one in the world that sees the world the way they do, the more everything is going to change the way you were talking about before. And the same thing you're trying to do on the podcast of just being like, hey, slow down, you know, you don't need to be rushing and jerking around. Life will actually go better. It's just, it's all telling the same story at the end of the day.
Yeah. That reminded me of one of the first questions that I worked on with my sponsor in 12 step. It was, how do we recognize that other people have different reactions and behaviors than us? That was the first time that I was 29 years old. It was the first time that I actually had the realization that other people could see the world different than me, right?
Yes.
Like when you say, you know, well, I don't understand why he reacted that way. You know, I would have, you know, yeah, well, That's how you would have, Andy. Like, yes. It took me that long to realize that. So yes, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
And I forget that we all have a story, right?
We do. And one of the things that is making me really excited right now is just being able to be part of a community where everybody is helping to platform each other. We're all starting out. We're all just being like, I have something to say. I have a story to tell. And it's not like to me, I don't, 0% of my motivation is making money or anything like that. Like there are the little shadow sides of me that are just like, okay, I got to check the stats and, you know, like who's listening and how, like I want feedback and I love the interaction. I love seeing how it interacts with someone else's world, but I have something to say and I don't even know what it is. And so that's the satisfaction is fully achieved in sitting in this 1 minute right here with you, having this conversation.
Yeah. And that's great. That gives me more confidence too. Cause it's like, oh yeah, you just talk it.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the least listened to episodes is one I'm doing by myself. Like, it's just like, I don't care. There is somebody, if there's one person who's going to listen to that, maybe in some fantasy world in my brain, and they're going to be like, they're going to hear something that just triggers an awareness that they've never had before. Just the right language of something that they already knew, but they never looked at it. And it'll make them look and maybe it'll change their perspective. It'll help their son to come up a little bit and that will start to change the world around them. And so it's just like, well, yeah, we should all be out here sharing our worldview. I actually have a choose your own question for you if you are interested.
Okay, sure.
Who or what is God? What do you know about God? Or what happens after you die? What's beyond this physical thing? Or is there anything? What's your perspective? Answer how you will.
I distinctly remember in one of my ceremonies, I had an out-of-body experience. I had the feeling like, okay, I've been here before. I'll be here again. It's all going to work out. Like, I've read so much literature and whatever gotten from guides that after we die that, you know, it's just a physical death and that there's a soul, a spirit or whatever that lives on. I believe that. I don't believe in, you know, heaven, hell, that sort of thing. Like you asked earlier about, you know, being Jewish and, you know, or religion, you know, that was something that I remember my mom was always saying when I had the issues with my Baptist girlfriend, she'd say, oh yeah, well, you know, cause Jews don't believe in hell. And it's like, have you read the Old Testament? No, she never read the Old Testament. So, I mean, I don't read the whole thing either, but I know there's a lot of
punishment,
angry
available.
Stuff in there. Yeah.
Yes.
I believe and have experienced that God, the universe, whatever it is, the energy is unconditional love, that judgment and shame. They're all human created. I mean, we can call it the devil or the whatever. One of my favorite books is Napoleon Hill, who wrote Think and Grow Rich. Definitely a must read. But the most recent book that came out called Outwitting the Devil. So he has a conversation with the devil, and instead of talking about the principles of success, he talks about why so many people fail. And it's so good.
Okay. That's on my list.
Yeah. And part of the question is like, oh, is he really talking to the devil or is it just, you know, whatever, does it matter? You know, the whole point
is art.
Well, the whole point is the message that how we get around this failure. But yeah, I don't think God is a man or a masculine or whatever.
Is God self-aware or conscious?
Absolutely. Has to be. Created everything. It's the ultimate creator. So he, she is self-aware and conscious to the extent that we are.
Then why us? Why the humans that can create all of this trauma?
Why us? Oh, why do we create the trauma?
Why if God is like conscious and self-aware, and I'm not trying to make your words more than you mean them to be, but I'm just saying, so why? Why the fuck? What's the point of this part of creation?
To create, to make manifest what we desire. that's what God does.
Then that's our purpose of being here.
Yeah, our purpose is to, that's exactly what it is.
And so here we sit podcasting. Hell yes. I appreciate you going on that little metaphysical exercise.
Like I said, conversations with God explains it much better than me. That book is my Bible. He goes through everything. He goes through
relationships. But I can read the book and find out how it feels to him.
Sure, sure.
It does not feel exactly the same to you. So I'm just curious about the shape of the feeling inside you. It doesn't have to make sense, but yeah, that's all I'm after. Like for me, when people ask me that question, I answer it differently every time because I just try to think, like, how do I really feel? Like, what is it actually? Because we use all these words like God and infinite and all this bullshit that means absolutely nothing. So I'm kind of on a mission to try to make those concepts actually mean something emotionally to me. And it's working. It's great.
Yeah, that's good. That's definitely going to make me contemplate.
Good, 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 good. Well, then I guess I'll ask. I think I know what you're going to say, but what happens... And what happens next? What happens after you die? What will you experience?
I can only, regurgitate what I've...
What? You don't have an opinion, a feeling about it?
A feeling about it? I mean, I definitely resonate with all that I've heard about being able to see your loved ones and traveling wherever you want on the cosmic journey. And
because you become part of that God consciousness, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yep. Well, that's easy. Okay, so, and on that just reminded me of a podcast I just started listening to.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even believe, anyway, it's the world is changing, but it's called the Telepathy Tapes. It's all following and documenting telepathy in nonverbal autistic people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, definitely check that.
It's so much beyond anything that you can possibly imagine just thinking about it now without having listened. It's going to change the world. It's like the world isn't flat. It's round. There are people that are spending their lives communicating with people around the world just simply using their, what they call their spiritual body or their energy body or whatever. That's where they live. They are disconnected from their physical bodies. And as they're learning to communicate with these, spelling boards and stuff that started in the 90s and are super controversial, they are saying, once they are able to communicate, they're saying, we just don't have access to our bodies. We're in here and we talk to each other and we're like, they just know things. They know languages and they know like all this stuff. And people are like, how did you learn this? And they're like, well, I learned it from this person on the hill. And they're like, what's that? It's like this person in another state or another country that they've never met before. And they have this like whole relationship because they just go and connect with each other on this different plane, this different wavelength. And it sounds crazy, but she goes through it very, very well, very methodically, very simply, and it is interesting.
Yeah, no, I believe it. Yeah, that's...
Check it out.
Yeah, absolutely will.
I don't know how I'm going to do it. It is so interesting to me, and it ties into other things. Like there's a author, Barbara Brennan, that writes the book Light Emerging, and it's all about this metaphysical... It's like a medical textbook, but it's about... everything but the physical body. It's about the energy body and all. And it's just like, it's such a different worldview, but I resonated with every word as it came off the page. And this telepathy tapes is just like on episode 8. And here she goes right into this metaphysical healing stuff. And I'm like, this all ties together. Anyway, it's so, so interesting. So
yeah, there's definitely more.
I might do a conversation about it.
There's definitely more than what we are aware of in the universe for sure.
Yeah. Well, interesting stuff. I usually ask, so far, I think I've asked everybody, what are you most afraid of? And the truth is, I don't know exactly what I'm after with that question, because the answers that are most satisfying are often just kind of like not even about it necessarily, but
yeah,
I'm curious, what do you feel like you're afraid of?
Oh, man. You caught me with that one.
Yes. Yes. Okay, well, so this has already been the most satisfying answer.
it used to be death. I definitely, when I would sit and really contemplate my mortality, I would start to feel some of those panic attacks. But that's where the ceremony experience really put that in check.
So the ayahuasca
is
what helped you get over your fear of death?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because I got that reassurance that there's something else, that I'm always going to be okay, that I'm being taken care of, that everything in my life has led me to this point, that if I think of all those times I was on the road texting or in the plane with almost, you know, the near miss or whatever, like, yeah, you know, like it could have happened. So I'm always okay. Yeah. It may not be like it sometimes. And I used to be, I mean, before my wife, certainly, you know, being single, there was the fear of being alone and all that. I'm very comfortable in my marriage and my relationship now. Like that's something that I like is way, it's just, there's no fear of that at all, you know?
But there used to be.
Oh yeah, there did.
Like you're talking about fear of like, oh, I'm going to lose my relationship or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fear of abandonment, right, probably. Abandonment. The most basic human fear.
Yeah.
So what changed? What changed to make you just feel secure there in relationship?
Number one, I picked the right person, you know, like, because that was.
It was a growth thing.
Yeah. And then, like I said, I mean, after my ceremony experiences, it just confirmed everything about my life and how. So she's the person for me, and there's no doubt of that anymore. A lot of those things, the abandonment issues and that kind of fear of financial insecurity. Like I was, you know, terrified before COVID. Like I've got to make calls. I got to have our business. I got to do all this. And it was when I stopped doing that I ended up getting my full-time contract, you know? So we're always taking care of money-wise, even though it fluctuates and all that. Like I've gotten so much better with that. So
sounds like you've come to terms with your fears. Maybe you still feel them, but they don't control you.
Yeah. Yes. Sweet. If I would say if there's any, probably, you know, any fears that I'd have to look at, it'd probably be around my kid, you know, like, but even that, you know, like I've worked through that. Yeah. I know that he's going to do what he's going to do and I can only do so much and be there as his, you know, dad and all that. Perfect. So, yeah.
Perfect. And nothing more you can do.
I hope that's a real enough answer because I know it's lame to go, oh, what am I afraid of? Oh, I'll get back to you on that.
I loved that was an exploratory answer. I loved that. Thank you. What final words would you want to leave the world with if you were going to sign your ticket and you were out? What is that important to you to say?
Just that all of my experiences between my traveling and relationships, I think what kind of rings out the most is follow your passion. Like I've generally always done that. Even from when I was, I always said when I was working as a freshman in high school, like I'm not getting a job because my parents are making me get a job to pay the bills, whatever. I got a job at that radio station because I wanted to learn how to run fucking radio station. And I did after 3 months, I knew how to run it better than anybody that was there. I got a job at Six Flags. It was my first real job. And I left after 6 months because I didn't like it anymore. It's like, no, I'm going to go do something else. I never understood the 30-year career path. I see people in LA that I used to work with that are still, or now they're just getting laid off, but they're still at the same radio station. They're still doing the same announcing. Like they did it for 30 years. I'm like, yes. I mean, I did it for 10 years and that was a long time. Yes, like I couldn't imagine doing the same thing. So I think
of us have lived that way and humans are not meant to.
Right. Right. So I would say that's definitely one of the biggest lessons that I've had through my life is like follow where you're supposed to go and don't, you know, there should be no reason that, you know, if a relationship is holding you back, you know, that's not the right relationship, you know, whether that's a job and spouse, you know, whatever.
That reminds me of a saying we have in this house. Do the thing. Do the thing. Just do the thing. Stop talking about it. Just do it. We actually have a trophy. That's a literal trophy. I think it's like a unicorn or something on it. And the inscription is did the thing. Like it just reminded me of that. Follow your passion.
Yeah. Follow your passion. And like we talked about in the beginning, that gratitude really is like the antidote. Like, because it's so easy to, get down on whatever it is. And that was one of my main tools when I was really at my, you know, depressed state was making a gratitude list. Sometimes it has to be really basic. You know, I'm grateful for my house and my, you know, whatever, but then it's like, you know, I'm grateful for my lifestyle. I'm grateful. Once you just start getting into that, it's, we live in a world of duality, right? It's either we focus on positive or focus on negative. Either we're growing or dying. There's no,
everything must be judged.
There's no in between, or at least not for long, right? That's just that very small fulcrum point.
I mean, that's how we see it. I don't believe that's how the world actually is, but yes, I agree. That's how we see it. That's how we're taught to see it. That we can't see it differently unless we come to it somehow, because that's what the Western culture teaches. Right or wrong, white or black.
Yes. When in the truth is that I was listening to some talk about, we're not in duality. That's why there's so many triunes, you know, in religion, is because is the reality. There is, there's not just two choices, but like you said, we can't see that or don't see that or whatever. Yeah.
But it's the infinity symbol. I mean, there's always infinity choices. At every juncture, there's infinity choices.
Yes.
As we progress through the time body.
And I think also as I, hopefully as my wife becomes more vocal, and maybe, you know, she mentioned like one or two times that she might do some kind of podcast or something. I don't think it's happening soon, but she does have a story, and we have a story in that we found each other, that she wanted to be a singer and didn't necessarily want to be a famous singer, but she wanted to be a singer, and she auditioned for all the shows and they rejected her, and she had kind of relegated her life to being a middle school teacher until we met, and I started training her to do dueling pianos, and now we have the lifestyle that we have, like, because we didn't settle, you know, we didn't settle
bro,
for the
bro. You duel pianos with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
That is beautiful. I love hearing that.
Yeah,
and that you're following your passion. And by the way, I haven't heard any of your content, and I'm going to listen to it, but thank you for sharing, because whatever the fuck you have to share, the world deserves to hear it.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate you saying that. And I appreciate you listening to me for the last, holy shit, over 2 hours.
No, I appreciate you letting me just ask whatever questions I want and having this conversation with me. It has been fantastic.
Absolutely. I'm honored and looking forward to continuing the relationship and
absolutely,
and supporting your podcast.
We can't have enough support. I love the community that this is all opening up. So thanks for your time.
That's great. You got it. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too.
Okie dokie. Now, end. Thanks for traveling another world with Emotion Art. If you enjoyed the conversation, please let us know. You can email me at michael@thisisemotionart.com. Your feedback helps build our momentum, which is just going to bring you more stories from other worlds. So let us know what you think, good, bad, or otherwise. Yes, please.